Cool. Well, our speaker today on democratic socialism, can it work, is Sarah Garnham. Sarah's part of the Socialist Alternative National Executive. She's also an activist at UNSW. So, yeah, everybody give Sarah a welcome.
All right, cool. Well, I want to begin sort of Year 12 debating style by defining the terms. I was not a Year 12 debater, just a disclaimer. But the reason I want to do this is I think that the fact that we're getting up today to make an argument against democratic socialism, which, by the way, is the argument I'll be making, is can seem misleading on the face of it. And so I want to allay people's fears, basically, that we're not for socialism that is not democratic. We are very much for a socialist society that is thoroughly and radically democratic. And I think, in fact, genuine socialism could be nothing other than radically democratic, because socialism as a system is based on popular control of the economy and on every single area of society. It's based on the distribution of goods throughout society on a democratic basis, and it will go well beyond, once you have that basic requirement fulfilled, the kind of access to democracy that ordinary people would have in a society where they actually get to decide where goods get produced, what gets produced, and every social question as well, would go well beyond the kind of ineffectual farce of democracy that's presented to us under capitalism. And not only does any genuine vision of socialism require democracy, but also the struggle to get to socialism must be radically democratic. It will not be possible to transform the social relations of society, to put things under the control of the masses of the population in a direct way, without a struggle that involves workers and oppressed people all over setting up organisations in which they debate and discuss and organise democratically in order to overthrow the capitalist system. However, the term democratic socialism does not generally mean the things that I just outlined. Actually, it is put up as an alternative to revolutionary socialism and to the things that I just described. It generally is used to describe a project that's about trying to build socialism from within the existing structures of the capitalist system, and particularly from within the state, rather than trying to overthrow the state. In recent times, there's been quite a revival, a very positive revival, of the idea of socialism in general, and I think specifically within that, there's been more and more people who are coming to call themselves democratic socialists and looking into democratic socialism. The term democratic socialism most notably was popularised by Bernie Sanders, who used it to describe his vision. And alongside Sanders, there's been a whole series of people in the United States in particular who've begun to describe themselves as democratic socialists, including formerly famous for being Miranda in Sex and the City, Cynthia Nixon. And she has quite a dubious interpretation of democratic socialism. She said that she's decided to call herself a democratic socialist because she's been a lifelong Democrat her whole life. And that's basically a direct quote. And by that she means the Democratic Party of America. So that, I think, is a fairly dubious use of the term democratic socialism. I think it's not irrelevant to the discussion of democratic socialism that there are people like Cynthia Nixon and also Bernie Sanders who use the term very loosely to describe things that are in no way, shape or form socialist. That's not irrelevant to our whole discussion of this project. But it's not the main thing that I want to critique. I want to critique the most left-wing proponents of democratic socialism, because I think that's the way to kind of mount an effective critique. And I think that, through that, then we can go and look at some of the more right-wing interpretations of it and so on. So the most left-wing proponents of democratic socialism today are people who sit on the left of the DSA and actually criticise the Democratic Party and criticise other sections of the DSA. If people are not familiar with that, it's an organisation called the Democratic Socialists of America. And it sees itself as kind of working a little bit within the Democratic Party, but opposing some of the central principles of the Democratic Party, namely that it defends capitalism. There's also Democratic Socialists who stand behind Corbyn and his campaign to become the Prime Minister in the UK, and there are sort of assorted people, you know, in an individual capacity calling themselves Democratic Socialists all over the place. Democratic Socialists say that rather than actually just providing a few kind of piecemeal reforms within the capitalist system, that they actually look to a transformation of the system and an organisation of society along the lines of socialist principles. So they argue that that means much more fundamental reforms than just things that, you know, for example, Sanders advocates for, such as free healthcare. So I'm going to quote from an article that was published in Jacobin recently by Neil Meyer, who is a Democratic Socialist. And he argues that the reforms that they're talking about are ones like these. Nationalising the financial sector, removing hostile elements in the military and police, introducing democratic planning and social ownership over corporations, though they say that the exact mix of that versus market socialism is a question for debate. They say it's also about rebuilding democracy by instituting public finances of elections, a ban on corporate lobbying, ban on private campaign donations, and writing a new constitution. And so all of this they aim to achieve by taking power through the parliamentary system. So by running in elections and then being able to pass bills and so on via the parliament for all of the things I just listed. So they argue that, therefore, the primary focus for socialists needs to be electoral campaigning. So they say, Neil Meyer says, we have to start contesting elections as insurgents who challenge the political leadership of both major parties. This work will lay the foundation for building a political party of our own, one with a mass social base that eventually can fight to elect a socialist government. Left-wing social, democratic socialists, sorry, also say that this primary focus on electoral campaigning and building a mass electoral base is not the end of the story. They argue that precisely because the reforms that they're demanding go further than ones that can just sit comfortably within the capitalist system, that there's going to need to be more things outside of the electoral strategy that bolster it and so on. So Meyer again says, a socialist government will come under immense pressure from the capitalist class to back off. At that moment, it'll be the job of democratic socialists in movements and in government to do everything necessary to defend the democratic mandate they won. This brings us to the critical importance of building the power of working class movements, the all-important complement to the state power exercised by a socialist government. Such movements can hold socialist governments accountable, helping them resist the pressure to give in to capital. Okay, so I want to briefly kind of summarise what I think should be a socialist criticism of this kind of project. I suppose the first thing to say straight out is that I think that all of the things that I just went through, which are the most left-wing articulation of the democratic socialism program, are not a strategy to win socialism. And actually, it's a strategy instead that's based on a massive underestimation of the antagonism of the capitalist state towards the working class. In addition, I think it's a massive underestimation of the interconnectedness between the state and big capital. And I think it is very much an overestimation of the democratic nature of the whole parliamentary process and that mechanism for getting within the state. Ultimately, I would argue, and I think history proves, that the proponents of democratic socialism and projects like it either end up failing to get anywhere near implementing socialism, or worse, as the logic of this impending failure becomes clear, they end up capitulating well before the final analysis to various aspects of the capitalist system. The debate between democratic socialism, which I think in the end becomes reformism, and revolutionary socialism is a very, very old debate. Rosa Luxemburg said over 100 years ago in her famous pamphlet, Reform vs. Revolution, that ultimately the two paths, the path towards socialism through the democratic road of parliament and the path towards socialism through revolutionary transformation, are not two different paths to the same destination, but two different paths to very different destinations. And by the way, we're having a meeting in Sydney about the politics and works of Rosa Luxemburg the week after next. So people should come to that to hear about her ideas, because they're very important, I think, and to have a really contemporary application as well. So that argument that actually democratic socialism ends up at quite a right-wing place is, I think, really important. I think ultimately democratic socialists and people that hold to that to the end end up undermining the social basis and chance of success of genuine revolutionary socialism. So they don't just kind of like rival it in some parallel way, but actually, because we're all involved in the same movements together, people that cling to the ideas of democratic socialism can end up contributing quite enormously to the demise of movements that could actually have the potential of overthrowing capitalism. And for that reason, not only is this a very old debate in the socialist movement, it's a crucially important one, and one I think we need to get right in the current context. Okay, before I go into unpacking that argument I just made a bit further, I want to say that I think there are positive aspects to democratic socialism and to the emergence of it today. I think it's a very good thing that millions of people are identifying as socialist and rejecting the kind of politics of like centrist neoliberal capitalism and so on. But also, in comparison to when I first got involved in politics and even, you know, the politics that sort of were dominant just a few years ago, the idea that socialism is back on the agenda specifically as a kind of anti-capitalist answer to the world's problems is, I think, a really great development. So a few years ago, for people that's political activism and stuff goes back that far, the dominant things on the left were things like working outside of the system to build like little niche communities and so on, to reject political parties because they're all hierarchical, to just try and build like lifestyle communes in the cracks of the system, and to not really look to the working class as a force for change in society. So I think the fact that today the revival of the ideas of socialism means a revival of the idea of looking to the working class, of actually looking seriously to building organisations that in some way or another can challenge capitalism, is really, really important. And it's great that we're debating these things, but as these debates go further and as more people do start to look towards socialism as an umbrella for understanding their politics and what needs to happen in the future, I think actually adding content to that and debating out what that means becomes more and more important. I think the revival of like democratic socialism and so on is also positive because it is possible actually to win reforms against capitalism. And so we as revolutionary socialists do not say that there's nothing positive to gain from people who want to implement, you know, variations of a socialist program in government. Actually, at certain times more than others, the capitalist class will be willing to cede certain reforms. But I think even that, like, often people actually overstate the amount that the economic kind of parameters of the capitalist system direct how many reforms can be established. The most determining factor of whether reforms can be established is actually the level of the class struggle. And I think pretty much in any context, if the working class mobilises enough power and pressure, reforms can be won without dismantling the capitalist system. You know, and we support those reforms being won. Related to that question is the fact that the process of people fighting for reforms and fighting to see socialists or people who describe themselves as socialists elected to government can itself initiate more and more people into struggle. It can raise the consciousness of millions of workers. It can provide a sense of hope for people in their struggles in the future. So there's not this kind of argument that revolutionary socialists should... revolutionary socialists should not abstain from or be dismissive of projects that emerge that are aimed at, you know, providing some challenge to the capitalist system, even when they're opposed in electoral terms. But I think what is important is that revolutionary socialists remain independent of those. So we are for supporting various like electoral projects that come up that can challenge aspects of capitalism. In Melbourne at the moment, we're involved in a project called Victorian Socialists, which is actually about trying to elect a socialist to Parliament to, you know, try and put some pressure on whoever forms government to make life better for people in Victoria. But I think that it's really important to not confuse that with actually some vision for genuine socialism. And I think that electoral projects that claim to be doing anything more than just trying to win a few reforms are by their very nature misorienting because they blur the lines between, you know, what might be a step towards developing class consciousness and putting pressure on the capitalist class and what might actually be the road to socialism. Okay, so I want to look to the state. I think the question of the state is the absolute heart of the argument between revolutionary socialists and democratic socialists. A guy called Benjamin Studebaker, who's a democratic socialist in America, argues that the state is this. The state exists to preserve and maintain order. The state will make concessions to any group of people that are strong enough to meaningfully undermine its order. So if the capitalists are on the upswing, the state will tend to make concessions to them. But if the workers are on the upswing, the state will make concessions to them. So essentially this argument, and it's made, you know, in slightly different ways by many people in the kind of democratic socialist tradition, is that the state is, in its essence, a neutral body that is there to administer the affairs of society, and whichever group in society is sort of wielding strength or whatever, the state will mould itself in the direction of their demands and so on. Argument, I think, runs contrary to how we should actually understand the capitalist state. The capitalist state exists, I think, solely to administer and run the capitalist system. It was built off the social relations of the capitalist system in order to maintain those. So one of the roles that the capitalist state plays is to manage the competition between different capitalists, which by its nature is quite anarchic, but also quite expansive. And so developing state structures that can regulate trade, that can provide some parameters in which the capitalist class can exert their interests, can vie for their profit accumulation against one another and so on, that is one of the essential roles of the state. For that reason, the state and big capital are thoroughly integrated with one another. So much of the state's functions have developed to organise capital for the capitalists. In addition, and I would say even more importantly, the capitalist state exists to police and discipline the working class. And I think this is a really important thing to step back and look at. Most of human society has not necessitated states. The idea that there are bodies that stand supposedly above society and police people's behaviour and make sure people stay within the rules and so on. So here I'm thinking of things like the police, the army, big bureaucracies that determine rules of how people can access Centrelink, how people can go about their business and so on, the numbers that are assigned to people when they enter the education system, etc., etc. All of that is a very new development in society, the idea that there are these institutions that run these things for us rather than groups of people getting together and determining themselves, you know, how to administer their affairs. And the reason that such vast institutions like these need to exist under capitalism is because the relations of capitalism are purely and simply about the exploitation of the majority of the human population by the tiny minority. And a lot of people say, well, that exploitative system where workers are forced to go to work for a wage, to give a part of their labour to a boss every single day and then to live on a pittance that's a wage, people would say, well, that's a market compulsion that people enter into because they happen to not hold private property and so on. But it's actually much more than a market compulsion because it's a market compulsion that can only be maintained by force. The state has to exist so that people do not actually just take hold of the surplus wealth of, you know, the society we live in for themselves. You think about every single worker, every single person every day who goes to work for a wage, yet on their way to work passes by like warehouses of food, passes by, you know, all sorts of the means of production. But we cannot just say, oh, today I'm going to, you know, go and help myself to the food I need, or today I'm going to get together with the people on my street to, you know, take hold of this section of society and so on. Because there are enormous organisational and powerful instruments that repress our ability to do that, that keep the majority of people in line in order to maintain the exploitation at the heart of the profit motive. So I think that is the key function of the state. In addition to that, the state is principally in charge of disseminating ideology that helps to justify those social relations as well. But all up, I think the state needs to be seen as an absolutely indispensable tool of the capitalist class, and one which was built into those class relations, and one which is there most importantly to suppress the potential power of the working class to seize control of society under a different type of logic. Okay, so that does not mean that the state does not have flexible components. So we're not saying that the state in some kind of mechanical way at every moment with every institution under its umbrella just enforces the directions of the capitalist class. Because the state is so huge and pervades so many areas of life, it has to compartmentalise itself. There have to be different divisions in the state which perform different functions, and those functions need to establish some legitimacy for themselves. So you think of something like the court system and the justice system, which is very much a part of the state. Well, it does exist primarily to discipline the working class and to maintain the private property relations of the capitalist class for the capitalist class. But because it needs legitimacy, it also has to establish precedents and kind of a sort of whole language and mode of practice that seems to set itself apart even from the rest of the capitalist class. And so at times, certain bosses might have to be punished in order to prove that, you know, this is no Mickey Mouse. The court system does not, you don't just get to waltz in as a boss and say, punish this worker or whatever. So sometimes they might have to, you know, scapegoat the old boss in order to maintain the legitimacy of this system. But if you look at the trends of something like the court system, overwhelmingly, people's class position is the thing that determines what kind of justice they get access to. I think the media, which you can also say is part of the state, is similar. Like the media, you know, a lot of the time the kind of big tabloid press just lies blatantly on behalf of the capitalist class. But then you have sections of the liberal media who don't lie all the time. And as Trotsky famously said, the reason this section of the media exists and is useful is because if they don't lie all the time, when they need to lie big, they can really, like, hammer that. And I think you can see that with things like the Fairfax Press and whatever. So, you know, different sections of the state can develop their own rhythms. They can sometimes go against interests of some sections of the capitalist class. But just that flexibility around the edge does not transform or change the fundamental nature of the state and its unique role in defending and expanding the interests of capitalism. Okay, so I'll move on to the question of parliament, because in terms of different wings of the state, the parliament is the one that people argue is the most susceptible to popular influence. And of course, this is the whole argument that democratic socialists make, is that it's through parliament that we can exercise some control over the levers of the state. I think that this argument is fraught in many ways. Firstly, the parliament is obviously rigged in much the way every other institution of the state is. And, you know, I don't think I probably need to go into that too much in this room, and most democratic socialists wouldn't disagree with that either, that, you know, the majority of people who get elected the majority of the time are the people who have big corporate donors behind them, and are prepared to very, very loyally carry out the interests of the minority class at the top of society. You know, so that's one impediment to the idea that the parliament can be a force for challenging capitalism. But I think that there's more to it than that. Firstly, it's important to see that the parliament is only one part of the capitalist state, and also one part of, like, capitalist society. And on its own terms, the Parliament does not actually claim to be able to redirect the resources of the economy or be in charge of things that, you know, fundamentally affect people in terms of their material access to the resources of society. So, for example, even if, like, the Labor Party get into Parliament in the next round of elections and get rid of something like negative gearing, this is not going to mean that all the homeless people in Australia find themselves a house. That the kind of parameters of what's seen as acceptable for the Parliament to pass and so on is very, very limited. So much of what actually determines our lives in terms of whether we have a house, how much prices are, you know, all of these things, what jobs are on offer, they're not determined by bills in the Parliament. More than that, though, if you do actually manage to get socialists elected into Parliament, or people who see themselves as challenging some of the more fundamental aspects of capitalism, these people will not find themselves adorned with all of the kind of prestige and legitimacy that parliaments appear to have when things are going well for the capitalist class. So in other words, the Parliament exists as a democratic organisation where the bills that are passed are respected and adhered to only when those bills and that program of the people in Parliament is actually permissible to the interests of the capitalist class. And when it's not permissible to them, they will stop at nothing to dispel the people sitting in Parliament, to just overwrite the laws they pass, and to often violently suppress the movements that arise to defend left-wing parliaments. So I think seeing that the way that the capitalist class do that primarily is not what democratic socialists claim, which is through capital strikes. Yes, that happens. Big capitalists will say to an elected parliament that they don't like, we're going to go on strike against you, we're going to move our capital investments elsewhere. But actually primarily the rest of the state, the many institutions staffed with people who are committed to running the affairs of the state, staffed with people who are not elected and so on, big bureaucracies and also big violent apparatuses like the military and the police, those organisations will be deployed to press down upon the you know, a socialist parliament. There's a good mini-series called A Very British Coup, which is basically this kind of hypothetical of, like, a socialist getting elected in the UK to be the Prime Minister. And he has this, you know, mass campaign, everyone supports him, he's got this great program and so on. And first day on the job, he walks into 10 Downing Street and he's greeted by what are called his staff, but which are actually just representatives of the state. And there's just this wall of, like, 200, you know, decorated generals, like, puffed up, you know, bureaucrats, all these people who are just sitting there being like, yes, we are a, you know, a force that you will not get through. You, one individual who, you know, just happened to get the popular mandate, you're not going to be able to contend with our organisations and our power. Yeah, we can also look to examples that were not hypothesised in British miniseries to prove this. So, for example, in Chile, which in the early 70s, a social democratic government, so not a government that actually said it would transform the whole of capitalism and bring in socialism, but a social democratic government that wanted to institute some reforms against the interests of big business, was elected. Within basically a couple of years, or a year really, that social democratic government had been deposed by a military coup, and after that, 30,000 people within a year were tortured by the military apparatus of Chile. Now, I think that this is an important point because not only does it go to the extent to which the state will actually be deployed against any left-wing people who do get elected to government, but also it goes to the question of the interplay between a electoral project towards socialism and then mass movements outside of the electoral sphere. So as I said at the very beginning, the democratic socialists say they do not just restrict their proposal to an electoral campaign. They're also for, you know, workers having organisations and all of this kind of thing. But they see those organisations as principally invested and set up to defend the interests of an elected government and allow that government to go about its reforms. Now, in Chile, it was absolutely the case that once the democratically elected Allende government came under attack, it was defended heroically and militantly by millions and millions of working class people. And I think that the fact that such a movement was mobilised cannot be seen as divorced from the fact that a left-wing government was elected. So again, this goes to, well, we actually think that, you know, left-wing governments being elected is a positive because it is those kinds of events that can inspire the organisation of millions of workers. But it's also the case that it was precisely the forces of the Allende government that demobilised those workers' organisations ultimately. So I think that people here might not be familiar necessarily with the history of Chile, but basically there were huge... The coup was first organised not at the sort of presidential palace or whatever, but firstly in the streets, and there was a state of emergency called by the military. Workers, just through their own self-organisation and basically support for the government, decided to organise militias to defend their streets against military incursions. They also started to set up committees and so on at their workplaces because the bosses had fled the scene or the bosses were on the side of the state of emergency and so on. So they started in some places to do things that were like putting production under the hands of the workers and whole communities and so on. But as this was going on, the political kind of forces around Allende argued explicitly that these workers should demobilise their organisations, that these organisations were going too far, that this is not what the, you know, Allende government's project was. And also, in addition to demobilising this movement that was actually the only chance that the government had of holding on to its power, the Allende government itself had created the conditions in which this coup was initiated in the first place. So Allende, when he was elected, made the conscious decision to strike an agreement with other sections of the state to maintain the military forces, to maintain the personnel within those, and to maintain loyalty to the existing constitution of the state. And so all of that that he entered into was basically because him and his forces believed that they could democratically corral the state in the interests of the working class. When the working class, on their own terms, in response to a military coup, which, you know, the military coup, by the way, definitely went against the edicts of the Constitution, but when the working class began to go against the edicts of the Constitution by setting up their own militias and stuff, this is the thing that the Allende government wanted to demobilise. Okay. So I think that in opposition to this... so basically, I think what we should see here is that the unleashing of revolutionary movements is not something that we say has to happen entirely separate from electoral projects, that there just inevitably are going to be electoral projects, people who come into power, who workers have an interest in defending, and that in and of itself propels forward a movement. But the argument we're making, revolutionary socialists make, is that from that moment, and actually before that moment in preparation of it, revolutionary socialists need to argue for the independence of workers' organisations and for workers to start to set up their own organisations, their own bastions of power that can rival those of the capitalist state, in opposition to the people who are arguing to hold on to the capitalist state despite the fact that it is being mobilised against the working class. So the reality of that is that we need to actually have revolutionary councils, like we saw in Russia in 1917, but like have been seen in many, many other revolutionary situations since then. And the reason revolutionary councils are important is they're actually the beginning organisms of a whole different status quo. They're workers and soldiers and peasants and other oppressed people getting together to democratically make decisions, not just about how their own workplaces are run, but about how the whole of society should be run. These are set up and initiated independently of the state. And it's only those organisations that could actually then be organised together to take control of society and to destroy the existing state that could then bring about socialism. And so seeing that in a revolutionary situation, you will have, whether they're just beginning to be developed or whether they expand to quite a serious degree, you will have organisations that emerge that actually contest the organisations of the state. And that situation where you have organisations under the control of the popular classes and then you still have the ones under the control of the capitalist class is called dual power. Democratic socialists argue that dual power is a bygone question. It's something that only emerged in 1917 in Russia and that it's sort of antiquated and silly to imagine dual power emerging again. This is wrong. In Russia in 1917, actually it was not the case that you just had starkly reactionary forces in the capitalist state versus the Soviets, and this was a unique situation because of the late development of Russia. In Russia, throughout 1917, you had a democratically elected government, the provisional government, claiming to represent the desires of the people, claiming to be attempting to implement socialism and so on, but that was working within the existing structures of the state. And throughout the year of 1917, the forces in that government more and more attempted to actually repress the workers' organisations, but they also themselves came under attack from the most reactionary wings of the state, like in Chile. So military forces, namely the Kornilov coup, mobilised against the workers' organisations, the Soviets, but also against the provisional government. And that was the thing that really exposed the dual power situation in Russia. That's something that again occurred in Germany just a few years later in 1923. It's a situation that's occurred in revolutionary struggle after revolutionary struggle, regardless of the development of democratic forces within particular countries. Okay, the other argument made by democratic socialists, though, about how things are no longer like Russia is actually that Soviets and workers' councils are not democratic, and that they would actually prefer the democratic structures that currently exist under capitalism. So people like Ed Rooksby, who's a democratic socialist in the UK, people like Polansis, who was a Eurocommunist, or is, I think he's still alive, argue that direct democracy as exists in councils, as I described, people making democratic decisions amongst themselves and so on, is not democratic. What is democratic is the secret ballot, is the one person, one vote system of capitalism. Actually, this is a very right-wing argument. It's one that's taken from Kautsky, who in his time argued against the Soviets in Russia and those in Germany as well. And it's about this argument is about defending the ineffectual and farcical nature of democracy under capitalism. It's about saying the only power ordinary people should have is to go to the ballot box discreetly every now again to vote for their representatives, who should then be trusted regardless of what their motives and regardless of, you know, there being no accountability against them and so on. They should be trusted to make decisions about the economy and society. So I think the fact that democratic socialists end up arguing against direct democracy of ordinary people is a really important point to draw out, that it's not just that they are naive about the neutrality of the state. It's actually that they prefer an elite within the state to be attempting to mandate socialist reforms rather than to put democracy in the hands of ordinary people throughout their organisations. Okay, the argument about democratic socialism today and some of its relevance, just to finish with, I think that, ultimately, democratic socialists, whether it's sincere and naive or totally cynical, actually argue for the integrity of capitalist institutions, and that will undermine the fight for socialism. There's, I would say, never been a democratic socialist force or reformist force that have not at some point actually played a key role in undermining the genuine struggle for socialism. So the Second International ended up undermining the whole social base of their movement and its interests by supporting their countries in World War I. The Eurocommunists supported the capitalist class against the working class ultimately. In Greece recently, there was a government elected of Eurocommunists who promptly, within a year, ended up agreeing to the mandate of the European Union and big bankers to repress the workers and to continue to implement austerity. This is actually the logical trajectory of a political project that says the key for us is, okay, we're for socialism, but the key for us is maintaining the integrity of capitalist institutions and finding a way through them. As those capitalist institutions prove to not wield to that, over and over, these people yield to the structures that they're a part of. And even before taking power, this is the case. So today we have someone like Jeremy Corbyn, who is not in government yet, but already has moved quite far to the right of where he was when he was a backbencher. When he was a backbencher, he spoke about open borders. He spoke against the racism that's part of every single immigration control. Today, his new policy is to stand for more immigration controls, is to rip up the Schengen Agreement, and to actually, you know, even though he argues for this on the basis of not exploiting foreign workers, it's to actually instigate more and more border controls and so on throughout Europe. And that's before he's come anywhere near power. Similarly, in America, where people are not even building a social democratic organisation or party that is actually first and foremost angled towards the working class, people are looking instead to the Democratic Party, one of the foremost parties of capitalism that's existed to administer the biggest capitalist state for over 100 years in America. They're looking to that party to effect change. So Bernie Sanders has become one of the role models for democratic socialists, even though left democratic socialists say, well, we're for going to the left of him. The whole logic of their argument, which is to start to make steps towards electoral power, means, well, at the moment, we should support Bernie Sanders. At the moment, we should support Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because these are all steps towards, a left-wing kind of transition within the state. But actually, to have people that you're advocating for who, before even coming under any pressure whatsoever from the capitalist state, have already moderated their program, have already said they're not for socialism, bodes very badly for the idea that one day they will change their mind and try and actually stand up to the capitalist state. So I think, just in conclusion, for socialists, revolutionary socialists, we have to say, well, we do not abstain from electoralism. We do think that the fight for reforms and the fight for socialists to be elected to parliament can be part of kick-starting processes that actually start to unleash or experiment with the power of the working class. But ultimately, we need to overcome the processes that got us to that point, and to put hands in the to put power in the hands of the working class. And that means being prepared to break with the people who say, till the bitter end, we will maintain the integrity of the capitalist institutions. We say, to the bitter end, we look to the working class and their democratic control of society. And ultimately, that means smashing the capitalist state.